Welcome to Fumbolden, episode 12.
Season finale.
Woo!
We were just doing, on our way over here, our recap of Grey's Anatomy season finale,
right.
Season 13.
I'm sure this will be just as action-packed as that was.
I don't want to be overdramatic, but if you are looking for something just as juicy, if you are just coming down from that season finale, this is a good place to start.
Right.
So this episode, we just titled it, Where Are They Now? This is the 12th episode, and like we said, the season finale of the first season of Fumbolden. And so we kind of wanted to harken back to our first episode and a lot of our subsequent topic-centered episodes.
Yeah, like talk about the lessons we've learned, kind of our insights about all the different topics we've covered in the past 9 months, and also what we would like to cover or like to change, and just kind of, I don't know, wrap this sucker up.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a big part of this is also going to be talking about how we've evolved from how we define feminism ourselves, and how we talk about our stances on a lot of things and why we're passionate about certain things in the first episode. Because, I mean, honestly, after going through, you know, these 12 episodes and a lot of them featuring guests and male guests, I've had, you know, my perspective changed on, like, several topics.
Yeah. The eyes have been opened, per se.
My eyes have been opened to other people's problems besides my own. Thank goodness. We wanted to start out, our main story today is more of my impressions from a really classic and lovely piece of literature that I am reading right now called Nice is Just a Place in France by the Betches.
If you're unaware, the Betches, are they primarily Instagram? That's where I found them.
Yeah, okay. Instagram, I mean, don't get me wrong, I follow them on Twitter as well.
So, social media presence.
Yeah, and it's just like very like carefully curated content. I mean, let's just say, like, they know their audience. It's very targeted media, and their target audience is me. But, I mean, I think they do quite well. I should have looked this up before, but they do have a lot of followers. And so they came out with two books. They are bright pink on the cover. The author literally says The Betches, so you can't miss them. And Nice is Just a Place in France. It does have a free ebook download, if you want to hit that up like I did, read it in class. So, although it's like mostly a farce and a satire, there actually are some really good nuggets hidden in there. And one that really hit me is they were talking about Snooki, of all people. So they were talking about...
We promised that this, like, actually ties...
No, it really does. It really does. And I guess to give a little more backstory, the title of the book is Nice is Just a Place in France, : How to Get Everything You Want. So I'm like, okay, I can use that. The sequel is I Had a Nice Time. It's about relationships. So in this particular part, in talking about, like, winning a life and getting what you want, they're talking about Snooki, and they're saying, okay, here's this girl, the books can be sometimes crass, they call her an orange troll. Not like a troll like that lives under the bridge, but you know, like those 90 troll dolls?
The pointy hair. Yeah.
So that's what they were referring to. So they're like, she's this orange troll doll, and she's a household name. She's like this truly trashy girl from Jersey, but everyone, like you say Snooki, and like every house in America knows who you're talking about. And so their thesis for this, at the end of this case study, they say, the reason that you are not Snooki is because you sit around whining about your problems, where Snooki realized her problems and learned how to use them to her advantage.
Capitalized on them.
Yeah, she learned how to capitalize on what she has rather than whining about what she doesn't have. And they're like, that's why she's famous and you are living in squalor.
I'm sure that's the only reason that I'm living in squalor.
Yeah. But, so, like, farce and satire aside, I thought it was really interesting as it relates to this podcast and as it kind of relates to some aspects of the feminist movement.
This podcast has basically been us capitalizing on all our downfalls.
Or just our whining about our inequities. Because their thing was like, stop whining about what your problems are and learn how to make your problems work for
right.
you.
And really, if we go back to the beginning, that's how this podcast kind of arose, is that we would always hang out and go on various rants about these topics, and we had the idea that somebody would want to listen to us. Listen to us rant about these things.
I mean, I do love getting on a good soapbox.
Yeah, so it kind of originated in that way, but I like to think that it's transformed into something more wholesome and productive, mm-hmm. with an actual goal rather than just a safe space.
Yeah. And so I guess if our were to, like, sum up, like, one of my biggest lessons from kind of this podcast journey, it's been stop whining and just and do something.
Yeah. That the times when we offer solutions to problems is more satisfying than just talking about them. I mean, you need to talk about them to understand the problem and open up your perspective and everything, but if that's all you do, then it's just, you're just left where you started, basically.
Exactly, except for more math.
Yeah. Yeah. The things we've talked about have been very complex. We're not saying that we solved the world's problems in our podcast, but I feel like we did find ways to combat these things that we talked about. Like, for example, I really liked, I can't remember which episode it was that we came upon this, but just the idea that as soon as you, if you give someone else the space for their perspective, which is different than yourself, then that gives you the right to have your own.
I think we were actually in that.
Do you remember which one that
was? I think it was about dating.
Dating, okay.
And the thing we were talking about it specifically is, like, don't be mad if you're not someone, quote-unquote, type.
Yes.
Because that allows you to have your own type.
Right, yes.
But it applies to
you can generalize it. Yes. So the problem there, I mean, it's a problem, and that, you know, we feel judged, and we feel that, you know, it's unfair sometimes that people judge us for who we are, and that kind of turns us off to dating. Yes, but the solution to that is to recognize that if somebody can have a very specific preference for something that I may not fit into, then that gives me the space to have a specific preference for something else. So that's just so much more comforting than just whining about the dating world, which I feel like is very prevalent in...
Oh, yeah.
In our original BYU environment, but also everywhere, is just complaining about wherever you're dating, and just blaming it on the area you're in or whatever.
Yeah, when instead saying, okay, like, this isn't working out for me, that's okay. Like, he didn't want to date me, that's his right. Like,
right.
Think of all these people I didn't want to date.
Right.
And then you don't become a victim, which I think is the real danger when whereas feminists or anyone belonging to really any movement really kind of sits in just the dwelling on the problem stage, is you just become a victim, which doesn't help anyone. And I guess I'm going to give another example. I really read books that are more than just farce and satire. But one that was slightly more substantial is I was reading Where'd You Go, Bernadette a couple months ago, New York Times bestseller. It was really funny and really substantial. But so there's one character in there who's particularly, like, put in there to be a farce of, like, housewives, like, the modern housewife. And she goes to these support groups called VAV, Victims Against Victimhood. And so, because she's always whining about, like, every problem in her life and sees herself as a victim, so she goes to these support groups called Victims Against Victimhood. When, like, and it's funny because she's only a victim in her own mind. Mm. And so we can all see this. Like, I could see this, and it was so funny as I'm reading this book, but, I mean, the truth of it is, like, she's a satire. Like, what is she a satire of? She's all of us.
Yeah.
Like, we all, like, at different times, we see ourselves as victims. Like,
I do have a criticism to that, though, because I think sometimes saying don't be a victim is used to justify the stance that there isn't oppression, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That by saying you're just being a victim automatically invalidates your feelings of oppression.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes we are objectively victims. But I think the only problem comes is when we just stay there. And we stay there and whine about being victims rather than doing something about it.
Yeah, like expect someone else to solve your problems for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, moving to a larger social scale, that's a really difficult thing to do when you're someone who's been in a situation that's, where you have been a legitimate victim of serious oppression. It's hard to say, to put the responsibility on you rather than the responsibility on the person who oppresses you. Because they're the ones, I mean, in a fair world, they're the ones who would take responsibility for those problems. But, I mean, we see in the early feminist movement and in the civil rights movement that, as difficult and as unfair as it might be, the responsibility lies with you to make change, enforce change.
Even if that change is just within your own mind.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of the things that we've talked about, it's less broad social change and more a change in the way we think.
Yeah. I mean... Again, like, we have to step back and say, I'm a middle-class white woman. I have lots of privilege already. And so I should make those changes within myself, and oftentimes it's not necessarily the structure's problem.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it, like, I mean, for example, going back to, like, the dating and Provo thing, like, I used to just be so irritated that, like, I would sit there in a congregation and there would be, like, these older white men up there talking about how men can best get wives and, like, how marriage is the most important thing, and if you're dating, like, I mean, if you're single, like, what are you doing wrong? And it used to just really, like, make my blood boil, like, when I'd walk out. I would just be so irritated. And then, I mean, and I think this actually could be a largely a part of us starting this podcast, realize, like, the problem isn't what they're saying, the problem is how it's making me feel. And so, just stop feeling that way. Like, I don't find their comments religiously relevant.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that has anything to do with my religion or church or the gospel. So, like, don't pay attention to it.
Yeah, I think that that's a definite argument, is where does the responsibility lie for... Well, where does the responsibility lie? Because, I mean, I've been in church meetings where I've been told you're not a disciple of Jesus Christ if you're not dating somebody, which is clearly...
Yeah, show me a scripture reference for that, please.
Yeah. Which is clearly, like, false doctrine, not on any level true. And so, I mean, the problem is with what he's saying.
Yeah, no, what he's saying is a problem.
Which kind of contradicts what you just said.
No, it is a problem. But...
Like, that's wrong. That's objectively wrong.
But me whining about it isn't going to change it. It's just going to make me mad.
True. And so, I mean, I guess the methods of action you can go from there.
Yes.
I can see two tracks. You can either go and attack the person, either, you know, not, like, literally attack the person, but, like, go, you know, talk to your bishop, say if that was a problem, you know, work it the way up the totem pole and see if you can remove the problem.
Yeah.
Or the other avenue is to... move forward on your own without that.
They're saying, like, I don't really care. Like, that's not true, and so I'm not going to really pay anything to it. And I think which avenue, it just really depends on the situation. Because I think on a lot of, like, individual skills, like when people say things or do things that are, I don't want to use the word sexist or oppressive, but you know what I mean.
Okay, hurtful?
Yeah, when people do things that are uncouth, it's just like, you can either take the action to confront it, or you can just say, I'm going to drop this.
Yeah, and I think that's a persisting question, is what is the threshold for taking a stand?
Yeah. And I mean, it varies on from person to person. I'm a very non-confrontational person. Like, nothing gets my anxiety running like confrontation. And so for me, I'm usually going to take route two.
Yeah. No, this is important to ask. I don't think we've ever explored this, is what, like, when you're in a situation like that, or in a situation which is blatantly sexist, what is the threshold for acting against that? And I don't think there's a clean-cut answer, obviously. Yeah. I mean, I would agree that it's situational. And I think in some cases it is okay to just ignore it and, mm-hmm. and I don't know, make effort in your own life to dispel...
negativity.
Right, dispel, I don't know.
This has actually been something, maybe not as verbose, that I've really thought about, but, like, I've really had this kind of going in my subconscious recently. So, my fiancé is in the finance program, which at BYU, we don't have fraternities or sororities, but the finance program gets about as close as...
It might as well be.
There's a lot of douchebags, for lack of a better scientific word, in the program. I resent that. So, we'll go to, like, a lot of events and things, and, like, they are... Oh! I mean, when we're talking about, like, personal, like, things that people say that you're just like, wow, that was, like, insanely sexist that you just said to my face.
Yeah.
I have never in my lifetime encountered, like, so many things that people have out and out
really?
Already, like, said to my face.
Really?
And it's a very sticky situation because these are my fiancé's friends. I don't belong to the finance society. Like, I'm very much an outsider. Mm-hmm. I'm a plus one. Like, I am not integral to this. And, like, also, like, I'm my fiancé's plus one. Like, and so I have this really sticky situation, like, that's arisen a couple times where I'm just like...
Yeah.
Am I going to pitch a fit over this? Or am I just going to let it be and kind of sit there, like, very docile?
That's hard, because I feel like in some situations when you let it go, you're reinforcing...
That this is okay.
Yeah, you're tacitly reinforcing that that's okay, mm-hmm. and they don't receive any correction or any understanding
that's very inappropriate.
Yeah.
And so it's honestly been something, like, that I've struggled with a lot, because I'm like, I don't want to, like, come off as very, like, super combative, but at the same time, like... You can't expect, like, these are, like, little business professionals to go in to the business world and, like, I mean, even something as simple as calling your coworker a girl who's a woman, like, that's offensive.
Yeah.
And so, I mean,
yeah,
Sorry, go ahead.
I read this article on NPR the other day about how women will address their male coworkers by the professional title, but men will only do it half the time. Mm-hmm. It was a small case study in looking specifically at medical professionals, but men will half the time not call their coworker a doctor, which is their earned title, and I think that kind of plays into that.
Yeah, that, like, there's a difference in...
But I can see that kind of crossroads where you're like, do I... Because then you become, like, shrill or...
And then you get the labels, and yeah. It just reinforces what they're,
like, already
saying.
Or bossy, or, you know, catty, or whatever. Like, do I address this and say, I'm a doctor, or do I ignore it and tacitly consent to them doing that again?
One of my favorite professors that I'm actually going to be a research assistant next semester, like, so she's a doctor, like, she has her PhD, and it's very interesting because I have all of my classes essentially with the same group of students.
Right.
And we'll go to, like, Dr. Thompson, who's a man, we'll go to Dr. Thompson's class, and all classes, like, oh, raise your hand, Dr. Thompson. And then we'll go to Dr. Weitzman's class, who's, like, a woman, and she's not super old. And they'll be like, oh, Professor Weitzman.
Mm.
And she'll correct people. She'll be like, it's actually Dr. Weitzman. Because, like, you call someone a professor when they have a master's degree, you call them a doctor when they obviously have their doctorate.
Right.
But she'll openly just, and not, like, in a mean way, but she'll, like, they'll say, oh, like, Professor Weitzman should be like, doctor. And I mean, like, 9 times out of 10, it's a man in the class.
Yeah, so the question is what to do about that.
What to do. And again, like, I feel like we come back to this in every episode. Very nuanced.
Yeah.
Like, so much nuance.
Yeah.
And every situation is different. So it's really impossible to say, like, definitively, like, these situations do and these situations don't. But I think, for me, the key is what will bring you peace on the inside. Because that's what matters.
Yeah, and peace on the inside doesn't necessarily mean ignoring it every time. Because I've had situations where somebody has said something.
And it just eats at you.
Exactly. Inside. Yeah, just dwell on it until it, you know.
Until you say something and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I think, because that's really what matters, is like, art is you. We talk about all these external factors, but like how we feel, like that's actually what matters. And so, like in these situations, like with like these like finance bros, like there have been a couple times where I've been like, actually, like, no. Like, don't say that.
Yeah. That's not okay. Class. So much class.
I know. So one of our other takeaways is that some of our perceived judgments have
steering all the way back around to where we started with the victimhood thing.
The victimhood thing.
Like, yes, victimhood is, I don't know. I don't really like using that term because people define it different ways.
Yeah, and there's a lot of connotations with it.
Yeah.
But that some of our perceived judgments, actually a lot of them, can have basis in our own insecurities.
Right. And sometimes, and I think this is really true with the dating culture and also with, like, when we talked to Kayla about the mom culture, that we feel that we might be insecure in something, or we might feel that what we're doing is against the social norms, and so we might perceive, oh, they're judging me. Like, I perceive all these things that aren't necessarily based in a real experience, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I get this all the time with dating. I'm very aware of how single I am, and so I feel like all these other people in relationships must be judging me or must, you know, look down on me. I feel like a, you know, second-class citizen for all these things, which I mean, I might have some evidence to back those feelings up, but other times I really don't.
Yeah, and I think oftentimes, like, we just elaborate these in our own head.
Yeah.
And so the problem just seems so compounded. Like, a couple years ago, like, I didn't even like when I'd go to my parents' church, when I'd visit them at home. Like, I hated going to their church, or, like, my parents' were, because I'm like, oh, everyone my age is married, they all just stare at me, like, what is Steph Graf doing with her life? And I, like, expounded that to, like, my younger sister at the time, and she was like, honestly, Steph, they don't care.
Nobody cares, yeah.
Like, don't flatter yourself so much that all these people are staring at you in church.
Yeah.
But more than half of them don't even know who you are. Like, shut up and stop making it about you. And I was like, oh. And that seems so dumb, but then, like, honestly, I didn't mind going to my parents' ward after that. So I'm like, oh, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think where this is especially salient is in dating and relationships, but also careers and motherhood. I mean, whatever your life plan is, there's some way that you make yourself feel insecure about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very salient way. By recognizing just the fact that, you know what, I'm really just insecure about this, and it's not, you know, I'm not actually being judged. I think that's a huge step in achieving self-satisfaction.
Yeah, that a lot of our problems we create internally, and they don't come from the outside. They can be extrapolated by, like, little things that are happening on the outside, but a lot of our problems we create in our own head.
Yeah, and we're not, like, trying to gaslight everybody by self.
No.
definitely not. Like, we've talked about real problems before. Like, there are real problems again. But sometimes they're not as real as we make they are.
Exactly. Or just to the degree that we think they are.
Yes. I want to change the word real there. Real meaning that there's a experience that backs that up, or, you know, a lot of evidence that backs up those feelings. Because, I mean, when you, even though your perceived judgment isn't based in evidence, it's still real to you. It's very real. The feelings associated with that are very real and can cause you to do real actions and have real behaviors and thoughts. It's just, you know, where identifying the source of those feelings of judgment.
Exactly.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Like, me feeling insecure about being single, that's not my grandma's fault when she asked me if I've been on a good date lately.
Yeah.
But when she says that, I just jump on it and blame it on her. But, like, the problem is my own insecurity. Mm-hmm. She was not insinuating anything. She's my grandma.
Yeah.
But so I think that's where a lot of these problems, I mean, even outside of dating, come from. We're insecure, like you said, about being mothers or about having a full-time job. And so then someone asks about kids or, oh, yeah, you have a kid. Like, no, why would you think that? Like, whether or not we think that.
Yeah, and then, like, weeks after you're, like, talking to whoever about it, like, can you believe
what she said?
Yeah.
When there was honestly no malice there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I can't even imagine, like, how many things I say that people are, like, to their friends, can you believe what she even suggested to me?
Yeah, and I think part of that is trying to assume that people have altruistic intentions, which is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to believe that you can assume that people have good intentions.
Or, like, even like my sister said, that people don't care enough to be making judgments about us.
True.
I mean, my world is so much in my head that, like, whether other people are dating or married or single or have kids or work or are mothers doesn't cross it. I honestly do not care.
Yeah.
Two soapboxes right in a row.
Wow, watch out, world.
So we also wanted to talk a lot about nuance.
Yeah, and I think this goes a lot with when we had our male guests on the show, both Chad and Joe. I think by opening yourself up to those, simply by recognizing that someone else has a different perspective than your own is so powerful, and especially when it has to do with nuance, that you recognize that your world isn't black and white.
And neither are other people's.
Yeah, exactly. And that decisions they've made haven't, like, you're not the one making those same decisions, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And, like, everyone comes from, like, these different experiences. And so, I mean, let's just take Joe. Like, he was raised, like, in his own gender binary. He was raised in this kind of toxic masculinity, and that's a problem in itself, but that's the perspective he's coming from.
Right.
And, like, that's what he knows. And so we have to, like, and I think this was one of our big takeaways at the end of that, we have to really come at it with a lot of, and this is very hard, with a lot of empathy and a lot of patience.
Yeah.
And a lot of understanding for the experiences and the shortcomings of others. Because, like, heaven knows, like, I have hella biases in my life that I'm coming from.
I was actually talking to my mom about this point about nuance the other day. And a relevant example is, and I'm going to try to do this as PC as possible, is the recent takedown of Confederate general soldiers in the South, specifically in Louisiana. They just took down, I think, General Lee. They took down a statue of General Lee. Yeah, statue of General Lee, not the actual General Lee. He is definitely dead. And a lot of people on the liberal side were just kind of outraged that it's taken so long. They're like, it's been 200 years. Like, why are these people still holding on to this? Like, these people are such racists to think that they would, you know, want to worship these Confederate leaders. And I think everybody, at least most people, would objectively say racism is bad, slavery is definitely bad, and fighting for slavery is bad. But I think what we fail to recognize is that the people who objected to the demolitions weren't necessarily coming from a place, from that black and white, slavery bad or good, or racism bad or good.
I'd say a lot of them, like, it had nothing to do with slavery.
Exactly. But we assume that because of the symbol of slavery that they hold on to those, that we kind of make this cause and effect because they hold on to the statue, they must
be racist.
Yeah, be racist or pro-slavery, which...
When, like, I mean, honestly, like, that has a lot to do with their, like, national,
their heritage.
Their heritage. I mean, like, just, like, thinking of where we live, like, I would be really bugged if, like, the federal government came in and said, we're taking down all of these landmarks in Salt Lake because they uphold polygamy.
Yeah.
And, like, this outlawed system. Like, how could you, like, be so insensitive? Like, you bigots, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like no, that's our heritage. That's where we came from. Like,
right.
We're not polygamous now, but, like, And so not saying I condone Confederate statues, right. but just saying...
Yeah, like, objectively, racism is bad. Objectively, slavery is bad.
But in everything, there's nuance.
Exactly. And I think we will become less triggered of a people if we recognize, or at least take the opportunity to recognize where somebody may be coming from. Because it's not as clean-cut as we may think. That's kind of the point I tried to make with that story. I don't know if I succeeded. But I thought that was a really relevant example of nuance and the power of nuance in creating empathy.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're absolutely right. That's where I'm coming from, is realizing that people are seeing things from a different place.
Right.
Than you.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting coming from a culture where there are distinct right and wrongs, and we talk about all the time there is an absolute truth, there is definite right and definite wrong, and trying to reconcile that with humans who are very fluid in their actions and behaviors and motivations.
Mm-hmm. So another point
which goes right in
goes right
to
in.
Our next point.
Intention defines behavior more than behavior defines behavior.
Mm.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I was actually talking with my good friend Stephanie about about this the other day. Just the fact that and this can go both ways, both in bad outcomes or good outcomes, that whatever your intention is, whatever you're trying to do is sometimes more important than what actually happens. And I think this is very valuable in any type of social movement. We're going to talk about feminism here. But if you're trying to open up your perspective, if you're trying to be more tolerant of others, and if you're trying to be more gender equal, I think that's just as valuable as if your actions produce salient results. Mm-hmm. It's somewhat controversial.
I actually don't know where I fall
okay.
on this one.
Yeah.
I want you
to disagree with me.
Because I think it can lead to a lot of, like...
patting yourself on the back?
Yeah, and, like, it's hard because the only one that really knows your intentions, like, that's you.
Right.
And so, it's easy, I heard a quote one time that, like, the reason that we are so, like, harsh on others is that we judge ourselves by our intentions and we judge others by their outcomes.
Mm.
And I think that actually is at a root of a lot of the problem, like, social issues we have today is that, like, I mean, let's just take the Confederate statue example. I, like, see myself, not that, like, I have any stake in this game, but that I'm like, oh, like, I'm not racist, and, like, I can't believe that, blah, blah, blah. Like, I see my intentions, and I see, like, the federal government's intentions. It's to, like, end these, like, symbols of what they perceive as racism. But we're only seeing the behavior of the people who are opposing. We only see that, like, they're protesting this.
Right.
We don't see, like, what their intention is to preserve their heritage. And so, and that's, like, a macro scale, but I think, like, on a very interpersonal level, like, I can pat myself on the back and say, wow, like, I did my best today, like, I didn't do everything perfectly. I actually say this to myself, I'm sorry, I'm not for you, but I didn't do everything perfectly, but, like, baby girl, like, you worked really hard. Whereas, like, maybe my boss would be like, no, I actually needed you to get a lot more.
Yeah, you're a failure.
Like, I needed you to do, like, 30% more than you actually did. Like, and so yeah. He sees my behavior rather than, like, wow, she really worked hard. But
I
like,
tell she was really trying today.
She really, really, I mean, she just came in and so that's really the dichotomy, is if I'm going to judge myself based on my intentions, I need to base others, like, based on others on their intentions.
True.
And, I mean, if I'm going to have, like, the harsh, but not necessarily harsh, but judge others based on their outcomes, I need to judge myself based on, like, what is my behavior, what are my outcomes.
Right.
Because I think it's, in my mind, it's that imbalance, it's that dichotomy that's actually a problem.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that intention without results is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say good intention with negative results isn't a lost cause.
Yeah.
I think would be a more diplomatic way of framing that.
Yeah.
Because the comedian and satirist Jon Stewart says that change is effort. And I like that because it shows you're trying to move in a progressive direction, whether or not your actions may always produce the results that you want.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just like the fact that you define yourself by intention and effort removes the absolute consequences of did I produce a net good result or net bad result.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of
and I
why
agree
I like
that. That's like a negative way to think. Because I think it drives to like perfectionism, which I consider very toxic, and just being too harsh on ourselves.
Yeah.
So I think that middle ground is crucial. But I think, I mean, bringing it back to feminism, which is what this podcast is about, that's actually where things get tougher for me because it's something I really care about. I mean, it's easier
yeah.
when it's some kind of nebulous thing, like, I don't want to call it taking down Confederate statues nebulous. No. But it's very unrelated to me.
Yeah.
It's very unrelated to me.
Something less relevant.
But, I mean, if there's something, like, a man says something that I consider offensive to me, like, I'm, like, 0-60, like, so fast.
Yeah.
But I just go straight for his behavior.
Well, I mean, here we are again at the boundary between choosing to take a stand and choosing to, I don't know, give benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And I would say giving benefit of the doubt is more empathetic stance.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, but taking a stand is the more effectual.
I know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's hard. And I would go back to what I said before, whatever will bring you the most peace. Like, a couple months ago, one of my friends said something to me that I considered, like, one of my male friends said something to me that I consider, like, very offensive. And I promise I'm not, like, hella sensitive, but, like, I feel like I'm telling all these stories that make me feel like I get mad at men.
Oh my gosh, what a victim.
I'm such a victim. But, like, he said something that was actually, like, very, like, offensive to me. And I think he could tell, like, on my face. And, like, in the moment, I just had no idea what to say. But so he sent me an apology text, like, an hour later. He was like, hey, like, in hindsight, that was probably, like, not the best thing of me to say. I don't really know what I was thinking. And so, I mean, he straight up apologized without me confronting him. But, I mean, still, for, like, the next 24 hours, like, I went and told my coworkers about it. Mm-hmm. I was like, can you believe? Like, what a douche.
Yeah.
And so, like, not even, like, knowing that, like, he didn't intend, it's like, I think a lot of times, and this is just a very, like, primal thing, I think a lot of times we don't want a solution. Like, we want, I don't want to say revenge. Like, we want
to feel validated in our feelings of outrage. We want the response to our level of outrage to be equal.
Yeah, because it wasn't just that he was like... Because
if your feeling of outrage is, like, at a 90%, mm-hmm. and the reactions you get from people are, like, a 30%...
It's not enough.
Yeah.
Which sounds awful to say that, like...
No, it's a very human response.
That he sent me this really nice text, like, apologizing, but I was,
because that diffused the external outrage validating your internal outrage.
But I was still mad. I wanted,
is why you went and told everybody about it.
Yeah, and I wanted to say, like, well, like, would you ever say this again? Like, why would you think that's okay? But, like, that's just so not needed.
The ideal response would be when he diffused it externally, it diffused it within yourself. And yeah, I think that's the goal to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily know how to do that.
No.
I think that's the eternal quest as a human.
I know. And it's the balance between logic and emotion. Because logically, I had no reason to be mad anymore.
Yeah.
He recognized what he did was wrong, and he apologized.
And if you diffuse it, then you create a connection with that person that I think can bridge some, whatever sexist gap may have occurred.
Yeah, exactly. But no, instead of bridging the sexist gap, I went to all my feminist coworkers, and we just went crazy.
Yeah.
Our whole shift just talking about it. Because what I had then was...
But at the end of the day, like, are you... Yeah, this goes back to our first point. Are you and your coworkers satisfied about ranting about that?
But the strange thing was, I really was. Like, because all I needed at that point wasn't absolution, it was validation. Like you said, like, I just needed a woman there to say, yeah, that sucks, I can't believe I said that to you. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not mad. Like, anger is gone.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly why that is. Like, yeah. Why...
And I don't think that's necessarily the ideal.
No, it's not. Definitely not.
Yeah. And again, that's how this podcast was born, out of our feelings for our need for validation out of our rants, mm-hmm. our feminist rants. But now, having talked to different people about all these subjects, I think the high road is definitely perspective taking.
Yeah, because like
and diffusing
because like that probably took him, like he probably went back to his car because and said, wow, like,
yeah. I think
what I said was
because at the end of the day, he still learned the lesson.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. He learned
and that's
like,
where the need for like taking a stand comes from. Is like, I want this person to learn a lesson.
Yeah.
And so since he learned the lesson,
I should be okay with it.
Yeah.
Ideally,
right? Exactly.
And I'm just a sensitive emotional being.
Right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
No. So.
Bring it full circle.
Full circle.
So we began this podcast talking about Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist and how she has a lot of contradictions between her feminist ideology and her actions, which I think we've kind of led up to this point.
Yeah.
And so understanding these contradictions, how can we still be feminists despite contradictions?
Despite our contradictions, which I think...
Despite our imperfections, our failure to reach the ideal every time.
And I think this episode really, I feel like in this episode alone, we've talked about, like, 5 internal contradictions.
Yeah.
And I think, at least for me, how we can identify as feminists is, like, when we try. And we're going to fail. There's no such thing as someone who's perfect in any movement. He's like a purist, but if we, I mean, like we said a few minutes ago, if our intentions, we see we have good intentions and we do the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with figuring out what's most important out of all of this. Because, again, in some situations, taking a stand isn't necessarily the most important thing as bridging a divide. Or sometimes taking a stand is bridging the divide. I mean, it's...
Or preserving a relationship.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes issues, I mean, always, issues are less important.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's going to ruin a relationship...
No, that's very good. Because I think in some veins, feminism is an ideology. And in some veins, feminism has social has personal consequences.
Exactly.
And so I think recognizing, is this an ideology problem or a personal problem, is very good.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I could argue with somebody about abortion or about birth control all day long, but that doesn't really have any personal consequences for either of us. And so that's not really that important if he says something offensive to me about birth control or whatever. Whatever. But if I'm talking to somebody who says degrading sexist things, that has personal consequences, and therefore I feel should be addressed.
And it's like, but I think it also takes realizing, is my soapbox more important than this person's feelings?
Yeah.
And in the second story I told with my other friend who said that offensive things to me, I was making my feelings more important than our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, not even my feelings that they were hurt, but, like, this rampage I was on was more important than preserving my relationship.
Yeah, because what you talked about with all your coworkers was the ideology of it. It's the personal thing had already been resolved.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something I really need to learn is... The fact, like, in this situation, is my ideology the most important? I think if I take the trajectory and become the person where ideology is most important, I will become one of those people on a Facebook comment page in the depths of the internet trying to, in the most offensive ways, push forward my cause, which is not the person I want to be.
No, and then all your friends unfollow you in real life and in fake life.
Right, that is clearly the path that I'm going down. So right here, right now, I'm turning around.
I'm turning a new leaf and saying people are more important than ideologies.
Right.
Sometimes
they intersect, and when they intersect is where feminism is most important.
Yeah, is where people and ideologies come together. But I think we should never put movements or ideas in front of relationships and how they make actual people feel.
Right.
And, or, I mean, like, I, like, just this last semester, there was this guy, like, another one of my guy friends, but, like, he was talking about...
There's always another one.
There's always another one. The new leader of one of the clubs in school. He was like, yeah, like, they had these, like, a president and vice president were both men last year, but they're going to make them girls next year. He was like, and I just, like, said, before I even thought about it, I said, I'm like, why would you call them girls? Like, why would you call them women? And it just completely, like... veered off, like, the course of our conversation.
Yeah.
Like, before we were having, like, a really great open conversation, and then, like, he was, like, on edge. And I remember, like, regretting and being like, honestly, it was not that important.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It wasn't that important. But, and now, like, not that it, like, ruined our relationship by any means, but, like, we were having a great conversation, and then, like, you just have to go pray. I'm sorry.
You had to go pushing your feminist agenda.
Pushing the agenda on me, which in some situations, if you had actually said something offensive, yeah. But like...
Yeah, or I'm sure there's a more empathetic, nuanced way to kind of steer him in that direction. But
he honestly said nothing wrong, and I jumped down his throat, and that hurt the relationship. And so I think one of the biggest things I've learned from doing this is that, and really just being aware of these issues and kind of bringing them into, like, my personal life, is a lot of, like, all the time, people are more important than being... correct.
Yeah. Yeah. People are more important than issues. And, I mean, here we are, raging feminists, coming to that conclusion. what a great place to end. Thank you for anyone and everyone who's listened to our podcast. We appreciate it. We appreciate the validation, although it probably shouldn't go to our heads.
We appreciate the feedback and for everyone who has followed us on this journey.
Right. We especially want to thank everybody who's joined us in the studio, who's talked with us, who's helped us open our own perspective. This has been a great, great time. I'm glad we ranted our way into doing a podcast.
Yes. So thank you, listeners. This is Rebolden Season 1.